Common Sense Conversations is a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Independent, nonpartisan, facts, and common sense since 1995.
Hello, and welcome back to Common Sense Conversations. I'm Steve Ellis, president of Taxpayers for Common Sense, TCS for short. And as you know, we're the nonpartisan budget watchdogs who read the bills, go through the details, and follow the money to see how wisely or not the government is spending your money. Last month, we talked about how quite literally $4 trillion, about the same amount the country spends annually on the federal government, were sloshing around in the system. Since then, the focus has been rightly on oversight and transparency. In the last few days, we've also been looking at the must-pass National Defense Authorization Act. Here to talk about it all are Wendy Jordan, TCS Senior Policy Analyst for National Security.
Hi, Steve.
And Michael Maragos, Policy Analyst for Energy and Natural Resources.
How you doing, Steve?
I'm doing well. And before we get into that, I wanted to flag that we had a win of sorts. Until this past weekend, Treasury Secretary Mnuchin refused to disclose the names of the recipients of the Paycheck Protection Program loans. These were created by the CARES Act, a really large Corona COVID-19 response package that would help keep businesses, keep people employed and keep operating during this time. And it was eligible to businesses up to 500 employees for a total amount of $10 million. Well, he was refusing to disclose any of this information, even when it had been subject to the Freedom of Information Act, which is contrary to what the original promise was. And we, along with others, opposed this. And this weekend, he announced that he would release the names of those recipients over $175,000. And I say a win of sorts because he's going to do it in broad bands. And so while it's not clear yet, it could be $150,000 to $500,000 or $1 million, which doesn't provide you really quite kind of the information. And the whole thing is hidden behind a fig leaf that there's some sort of proprietary information tied to payroll data. So anyway, we're going to keep fighting on that and all the other transparency measures. We've had conversations with the Pandemic Response Accountability Committee, and they've got a website up to be able to track the funding. We should start seeing data next month in that website on the spending. But to go back to what we were originally talking about that we were going to go forward with, we're here with Wendy to find out what's in the NDA and where we are. So Wendy, talk to me about tying the Pentagon's hands, commissaries and lawmakers playing Oprah. You get an F-35, you get an F-35, and you get an F-35.
Yes, Steve, you're exactly right about that. It is, it's very much like being in the Oprah audience these days. Everybody gets something. Everybody gets a nice parting gift to take home. So let's just refresh our audience that the National Defense Authorization Bill is a policy bill. So the authorizers can write whatever pie-in-the-sky numbers they want to into their bill, their version of the bill, and that's the House Armed Services Committee and the Senate Armed Services Committee, but they can't actually cause a single dollar of tax dollars to be spent. That's done by the Appropriations Committees, who will start working on the bills in early July. But this year, the Senate Armed Services Committee was the first out of the gate, and they finalized their bill all the way through full committee and now are awaiting floor action in the Senate, which was tentatively going to be this week. Now it looks like it's not until next week at the earliest. Overall, from a non-binding dollar figure issue, they stay within the budget caps that were part of the Budget Control Act as amended. So all told for national security, the authorized level is $740.5 billion. Of that, $705.5 billion is actually for the Pentagon in base budget or in the supposedly off budget, but still adding to your deficit, overseas contingency operations account. As you said, more F-35s for everyone, even if they didn't ask for them. The Air Force got an additional 12 F-35s or authorized for an additional 12 F-35s in this Senate version of the bill, the Navy an additional two, and the Marine Corps an additional two, which is the hardest for us to swallow because although the Air Force and the Navy on their so-called unfunded priorities lists, you know, unfunded in a $705 billion request, they did put these additional airframes on their priorities list. The Marine Corps did not put any additional F-35s on their unfunded priorities list. And the commandant of the Marine Corps in March, or maybe February, put out a new planning guidance for the Marine Corps on how he sees the Marine Corps being built for by 2030, the year 2030. And as part of that, he said that he believes that Marine Corps squadrons can go from 16 F-35s per squadron to 10. So already suggesting that they're going to need fewer, not more. But Senate Armed Services Committee said, nope, you get an extra two. Ironically, the Air Force seems to be in the congressional woodshed. I don't know why that is, but in both the Senate and the House versions of the bill, the Air Force is basically told you may not divest aircraft in broad categories of types of aircraft. And in fact, the Senate directs the Air Force to set a minimum number of airframes for each major mission area and forbids them from dropping below that number of aircraft. At TCS, we feel like that's one of the big reasons that you end up having these massively large defense bills is no weapon system is ever allowed to fade away.
And it's not like the Pentagon, you know, if they're telling you they don't need something, that's not normally their way of operating, right? I mean, they generally want everything and more, which is why you have an unfunded priorities list, even though if you've got $700 billion, I think by definition, anything that isn't under that isn't really a priority.
Right. It's astonishing.
Steve, if you want to take their cue and just hand out raises to the staff without us asking for them, I don't think we'd object.
Interesting negotiating tactic, Michael, right here on the Common Sense Conversation.
And a new car. Anyway, the closer readers of TCS we'll have noticed that we have take a very dim view of special funds like OCO being created that are supposedly off budget. And within OCO, a program called the European Deterrence Initiative has been around for a few years. And now both the House and the Senate have a brilliant idea of having a Pacific Deterrence Initiative, which will spend billions of dollars. The Senate directs the SECDEF to make a request of $5.5 billion next year for Pacific Deterrence Initiative, which is brand new, and will be funded out of OCO. OCO, which next year in FY22, in the next year's budget request, is supposed to go down to $20 billion. But $5.5 billion of it will be for this brand new program. And frankly, if I was the president of a fragile Pacific nation, I would not be reassured that the money for this great new initiative to help us in the Pacific is actually in a contingency fund, which is budgeted to go away.
And I will also flag, we always found it interesting that we went from the European Reassurance Initiative to the European Deterrence Initiative in this administration. And then we're supposedly deterring the Pacific, which seems kind of interesting as well. So some of their name picks are kind of interesting.
Yeah. You mentioned the idea that the issue of the commissaries and exchanges. This is something we've been writing about for a number of years. There was a plan that, you know, fingers crossed, was going to go through to consolidate or close some commissaries and exchanges. Not so fast, says the House Armed Services Committee. We have to study that first. They have to do a budget cost analysis. I don't think that is it. A business analysis of consolidating or closing commissaries. And, you know, I've been in Washington a lot of years. The fastest way to kill something is to study it to death. Actually, it's not the fastest way to kill something, but it's an efficient way to kill something.
And it's not like this issue hasn't come up before. And you know, I mean, for our listeners, I mean, a commissary is basically a grocery store. And an exchange is basically a department store, which I'm sure many of you have shopped at, you know, regularly, and that are nearby almost all the bases and are available to the people who work and live there.
So I'll stop there. There are a few other things which you can get to later. And there's a lot of detail in hundreds and hundreds of pages of these two reports. And we'll be writing about it. And people can go to our website and read all the little tidbits of things that we found at taxpayer.net.
Great. And well, and before we take a little mid-show break, Wendy, can you remind me where we are in the appropriations process? I mean, what's next? And then, you mentioned the BCA as amended. I would just flag that they amended it to add, $300 billion more in deficit spending in the Bipartisan Budget Act of 2019, which covered the funding for FY20 and FY21. But on appropriations, Wendy.
The House appropriators will be beginning their subcommittee markups just after the 4th of July break, I think the 6th, I think, of July. They have quite a compressed schedule. They plan on going through subcommittee marks and directly to full committee marks in that week. I don't believe that they will be able to get 12. It would be some very long days to get 12 appropriations bills through subcommittee and full committee in a week. So my guess is it'll go over a 2-week period. And then, of course, they have to go to the floor. And then we start the process all over again in the Senate.
Gotcha. Well, we know you will be following along with all of our other colleagues, the money there in the appropriations process. And as a quick reminder, you're listening to Common Sense Conversations with Taxpayers for Common Sense. I'm Steve Ellis, the president of TCS. And we're talking about all the ways your money is being spent and being used. That was just Wendy talking about the National Defense Authorization Act. But I'd like to turn to Michael Maragos, policy analyst for Energy and Natural Resources, and to talk a little bit about some of the work they've been doing over there. Now, Michael, you've been digging around, no pun intended, on royalty relief for oil and gas companies. I mean, so what are royalties and how do they spell relief from COVID-19? Or, as I think you're going to tell me, actually not.
I think what a lot of people may not realize is that a huge source of income to the federal treasury that doesn't come from taxes comes from royalties and other revenues derived from natural resource production on federal lands and federal waters. Here in the U.S., where we don't have any big state-run oil agency like you might find in other countries, we have this agreement, and we have since 1920, that private companies can come on federal land, look for oil and gas reservoirs, and develop it and sell it. And in exchange, we charge them a set percentage, and that percentage is the royalty rate. For federal taxpayers, unfortunately, we've been getting kind of a raw deal for a while now. The royalty rate on federal land is 12.5%, where it has been stuck since 1920, the Mineral Leasing Act. And if you can compare that to other states, you can see even before this crisis, we were not getting as much as we should for what are very valuable resources.
So that compares to what private landowners and state landowners, I mean, like what is some of the rough percentages or
sure.
who is doing it right as a state or whatever?
Right. If you take a quick survey of our biggest oil and gas producing states in the country, you all see they're all charging more than 12.5%. At the very high end, you'll see Texas on state lands. If you want to produce there on certain leases, they'll charge you 25%. Fully double of what the same producers will get charged for producing on federal lands. But in most states, you'll see either 18.75%, which is what we charge for offshore production, where I would note that costs tend to be higher. And other than that, you'll also see quite commonly 16.67% charged by many of these states. In fact, we came out with a report earlier in the year just trying to add up a total of how much more we could have gotten had federal policymakers or the Bureau of Land Management, which is the agency in charge of managing onshore federal oil and gas, if they had started charging 18.75% decades ago, we could have earned an extra $12.4 billion over the last decade. So that's just to give you where we were before this current crisis.
Right. And so now they're saying that this is too much to pay because of the oil glut. But in reality, we know that their problems predate the oil glut. They predate COVID, and it's just a, you know, is this just another giveaway, Michael?
I think that's a reasonable conclusion. What we normally see with the oil and gas industry is they do operate on a boom and bust cycle. It's kind of inevitable when you have sort of prices determined in an international market for a commodity good. And in this case, since 2014, 2015, when you had a real downturn in the market and a steep decline in the price of oil, the industry has been sort of trying to find its legs. But over the last year and a half in particular, we've started seeing a steady drip of really negative headlines concerning the industry. I think one stat that's important to point out is that by the end of 2019, bankruptcies in the oil and gas sector had surged by more than 50% compared to 2018. So this was just coming into the year. In the past few years, they've been amassing huge piles of debt. And so a lot of these companies were kind of limping into the year to start with. And then what we saw in early February and March was that a group of countries led by Russia had a disagreement with OPEC, you know, not led by Saudi Arabia, and that itself led to a price decline sort of independent of what was happening with the pandemic and the drop in demand, which has factored in since then. And that's simply because there's a mismatch between global supply and global demand, an oil glut. And it doesn't take a sophisticated economist to tell you that is going to reduce the price of oil. And so the industry and not as a unified voice, I'll point out, but the industry started crying foul and pleading for aid along with all the other industries who were hit because of reduced demand because of the pandemic.
And so what are some of these other things that they've either contemplated, you know, I mean, sure, it's been kind of crazy ideas of paying them to keep the oil in the ground and then produce it later. And so, I mean, yeah, can you detail some of the belt and suspenders approach of trying to support the oil industry?
Yeah. It's been very clear from day one, really, that this administration places a high priority on fulfilling what this industry wants. And so during the current crisis, they've been very receptive, throwing out ideas, you know, by the day or by the week initially. And so they, some of their first response was, okay, well, we'll try and buy as much oil as we can for the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And then later they said, oh, well, maybe we'll lease it. And then in a bizarre move, they claimed that they wanted to extend what is considered the Strategic Petroleum Reserve to places that don't fit within the caverns that hold the oil that constitute the Strategic Petroleum Reserve. And so they would be paying producers to keep oil where it is, essentially paying them not to produce, which thankfully for taxpayers was an idea that went nowhere. But in addition, they've continued to do other things. One thing that's caught a lot of attention has been the role of the Federal Reserve and some of the moves they've made to expand some of their lending programs, which they will say they never act to the benefit of any one industry. But some of their moves look suspiciously like trying to accommodate the financial shape of oil and gas companies, most notably in late April. They expanded what they called the Main Street Lending Program to allow companies to qualify who had up to six times, they had debt six times their income. They had increased it from four times their income.
And they wouldn't have originally qualified. I mean, the Fed modified what they originally had said was going to be the program, right?
Yes. They've actually modified it twice now, in both cases, creating a greater opportunity for companies that fit a profile very similar to what we see with oil and gas companies, which is very heavily debt laden and those with very poor prospects in the near term. So people who won't be able to pay back their loans for a couple of years. The Fed has since said, okay, well, you don't really have to start paying us back until the third year of some of these loans, which is an adjustment that a lot of people are pointing to, as well as the increased amount of debt that companies who can qualify can have and what they're allowed to use these loans for, including refinancing existing debt. All of those characteristics are things that are helpful to the oil and gas industry.
Yeah, and I mean, the Fed's been very aggressive, not just on oil and gas, but getting into the junk bond market, paying BlackRock to administer that, and some things that we've got some concerns about generally, where we think that they could operate in a different way and even set up their own ETF. And so, but that's subject for another day. But so how aggressive have they been doing on leaving aside, moving away from the Fed, how aggressive have they been in awarding royalty relief to these companies? And what are we looking at?
Yeah, let me step back a second and say that as part of our larger program, sort of tracking what's going on federal lands and how the Bureau of Land Management in the Trump administration has been sort of administering what are these valuable oil and gas resources. To give you a sense of scope, about 24, 25 million acres of federal land is currently leased for oil and gas development. And in April, eventually the Bureau of Land Management came out with guidance that said, operators, hey, anyone operating a federal lease, you can apply for royalty relief on a case-by-case basis. And the wording of that guidance, I think a lot of people rightly pointed to as being very friendly with industry at a time, in a moment when you wouldn't expect us to be rushing to give away as much as we could. Bureau of Land Management is supposed to be acting on our interest as taxpayers to get as much as we can to get a fair return for the development of these oils like a private or a state landowner would. And so what they recommended was saying, instead of paying 12.5% of whatever the sales value of oil and gas you're pumping to the taxpayers, we're going to use as an example in this guidance. You could ask us to only pay 0.5%, not 5%, 0.5%. So reducing their effective royalty rate to sort of one quarter of, well, 1/25th of what it was otherwise. And it seems that certain states have been really willing to take that up. I should note that the Bureau of Land Management, unlike other agencies, is not entirely centrally managed. A lot of the state offices have a lot of discretion on the management of these individual leases. And not surprisingly, we find that in states that are bigger oil and gas producers, the BLM office in those states tends to be a little bit more friendly in their administration. So in particular, we've seen that Wyoming has been leading the pack in granting not just the most amount of relief, but also granting every single lease to date that 0.5% rate that the BLM initially published in their guidance.
So more Oprah, you get relief, you get relief, yeah, you get relief too.
Yes, everyone is getting royalty relief. There's a few interesting things. Let me just give the broad numbers here. So far, we have seen in their database system, and I'll get into it in a second of why their data is not quite that reliable. But what we do see in the data so far is that a total of 228 leases across three states, led by Wyoming with 144 leases, have gotten royalty relief. And these leases cover a total of about 170,000 acres of federal land. And I would note that we're grabbing this data from a system called the Legacy Rehost 2000, which is kind of what it sounds like. It's a very janky old computer system that is really inaccessible, very hard. But you know, TCSF prides itself in diving into the mundane, boring details, and so that's what we've done. And we're seeing that things that some of the leases that we found out yesterday got royalty relief originally applied back in April 16th or April 23rd. So we're getting data that's now 2 months late. So we suspect that in the coming days and weeks, we're going to find a lot more royalty relief has been granted than what's publicly available. Not to mention, we haven't seen anything input into the agency's database about New Mexico or other states where we would expect that operators would have been filing a great deal of applications for this relief.
Well, you know, as people following us know, we love a good tracker. And so thank you, Michael, for summarizing all that and taking that in. And we have also on our website a tracker for the industry requests of COVID-19. We also have tracking all of the spending packages that are coming out dealing with COVID-19. And it's right there front and center on our website, www.taxpayer.net. And also, you know, we're going to be expecting another package in the coming weeks, probably right after the 4th of July recess, that'll also be quite a doozy. There's a bunch of proposals that have gone around. The administration has talked about supporting increased spending. And so I just want to thank Wendy and Michael for joining us today. And then there you have it, folks, another Common Sense Conversation. And if you have a question, we keep them in the queue. Just send it to president@taxpayer.net and we'll answer them as soon as we can. So until next time, I'm Steve Ellis, and this has been a Common Sense Conversation. Stay safe, stay healthy, and stay in touch.
You've been listening to Common Sense Conversations, a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. To find out more about us, go to www.taxpayer.net.